This episode of the Ortho Bullets podcast will go over the topic of PCL injury from the knee and sports section on orthobullets.com. Let's start this episode with a quick summary. PCL injuries are traumatic knee injuries that may lead to posterior knee instability and often present in combination with other ipsilateral ligamentous knee injuries, for example, posterolateral corner injury and or an ACL injury. Diagnosis can be suspected clinically with a traumatic knee effusion and increased laxity on a posterior drawer test, but requires an MRI for confirmation. Treatment can be non-operative or operative depending on the severity of injury to the PCL, as well as concomitant injuries to surrounding structures and ligaments in the knee. Now, let's get into the episode. With respect to the epidemiology, the incidence of PCL injury is 5 to 20% of all knee ligamentous injuries. Moving on to etiology, as far as the pathophysiology, the mechanism of a PCL injury is a direct blow to the proximal tibia with a flexed knee, which is the case in a classic dashboard injury. Other mechanisms of injury to the PCL include a non-contact hyperflexion with a plantar flexed foot, as well as a hyperextension injury. As far as the pathoanatomy, the PCL is the primary restraint to posterior tibial translation, and it functions to prevent hyperflexion / sliding. Isolated injuries cause the greatest instability at 90 degrees of flexion. Associated conditions with a PCL injury include a combined PCL and posterolateral corner injury. Other associated conditions may include multiligamentous knee injuries or knee dislocations. Now let's quickly go over some relevant anatomy. As far as the PCL anatomy, the origin of the PCL is the posterior tibial sulcus below the articular surface, and the insertion is the anterolateral medial femoral condyle. And remember that the PCL has a broad, crescent-shaped footprint. As far as the dimensions of the PCL, it is 38 millimeters in length times 13 millimeters in diameter, and the PCL is 30% larger than the ACL. The PCL has two bundles, the anterolateral bundle and the posteromedial bundle. The anterolateral bundle is tight in flexion and is the strongest and most important for posterior stability at 90 degrees of flexion. Remember that the ACL has an anteromedial and a posterolateral bundle, and a good way to remember that the PCL has an anterolateral and posteromedial bundle is the mnemonic PAL, where the P in PAL represents PCL and the AL in PAL represents the anterolateral bundle. The posteromedial bundle in the PCL is tight in extension. Remember, the anterolateral bundle is tight in flexion, and the posteromedial bundle has a reciprocal function to the anterolateral bundle. The PCL lies between the meniscofemoral ligaments, that is the ligament of Humphrey, which is anterior, and the ligament of Risberg, which is posterior. Remember that H in Humphrey comes first in the letter of the alphabet, which is a good way to remember that it's anterior, and the W in Risberg comes later in the alphabet, which is a good way to remember that it is posterior. The meniscofemoral ligaments originate from the posterior horn of the lateral meniscus and insert into the PCL substance. As far as blood supply for the PCL, this is supplied by the branches of the middle geniculate artery and fat pad. As far as the biomechanics of the PCL, the strength is 2,500 to 3,000 newtons posterior, and the PCL minimizes posterior tibial displacement by 95%. Moving on to the classification of PCL injuries, the classification is based on posterior subluxation of the tibia relative to the femoral condyles with the knee in 90 degrees of flexion. And this is typically divided into three grades. Grade 1 is a partial tear, that is 1 to 5 millimeters of posterior tibial translation, and the tibia remains anterior to the femoral condyles. Grade 2 is complete isolated, and it represents 6 to 10 millimeters of posterior tibial translation, and this is considered a complete injury in which the anterior tibia is flush with the femoral condyles. Grade 3 is a combined PCL and capsuloligamentous injury that is characterized by greater than 10 millimeters of posterior tibial translation. The tibia is posterior to the femoral condyles and often indicates an associated ACL and or posterolateral corner injury. As far as the presentation of a PCL injury, you have to differentiate between high and low energy trauma, such as a dashboard injury or a hyperflexion athletic injury with a plantar flexed foot. Also, make sure to ascertain a history of dislocation or neurologic injury. Symptoms of a PCL injury may include posterior knee pain and or instability. Instability is often subtle or asymptomatic in isolated PCL injuries. On physical exam, make sure to test varus/valgus stress. Laxity at 0 degrees indicates an MCL/LCL and PCL injury, while laxity at 30 degrees alone indicates an MCL/LCL injury. To look for a posterior sag sign, the patient lies supine with the hips and knees flexed to 90 degrees as the examiner supports the ankles and observes for a posterior shift of the tibia as compared to the uninvolved knee. The medial tibial plateau of a normal knee at rest is 10 millimeters anterior to the medial femoral condyle. An absent or posteriorly directed tibial step-off indicates a positive posterior sag sign. A posterior drawer test at 90 degrees of flexion is done with the knee at 90 degrees of flexion, and a posteriorly directed force is applied to the proximal tibia and posterior tibial translation is quantified. Isolated PCL injuries translate greater than 10 to 12 millimeters in neutral rotation and 6 to 8 millimeters in internal rotation. Combined ligamentous injuries translate greater than 15 millimeters in neutral rotation and greater than 10 millimeters in internal rotation. A posterior drawer test is the most accurate maneuver for diagnosing a PCL injury. In a quadriceps active test, a patient will attempt to extend a knee flexed at 90 degrees to elicit quadriceps contraction. The test is positive if anterior reduction of the tibia occurs relative to the femur. In a dial test, greater than 10 degrees of external rotation asymmetry at 30 degrees and 90 degrees is consistent with the posterior lateral corner and PCL injury. Greater than 10 degrees of external rotation asymmetry at 30 degrees only is consistent with an isolated posterior lateral corner injury. A KT1000 and KT2000 knee ligament arthrometers are used for standardized laxity measurement, although this is less accurate than for an ACL. As far as imaging, recommended views on radiographs include AP and supine lateral, and on these views you may see an avulsion fracture with acute injuries. This is also useful to assess for posterior tibiofemoral subluxation, as well as medial and patellofemoral compartment arthrosis, which may be present with chronic injuries. In a lateral stress view, apply stress to the anterior tibia with the knee flexed to 70 degrees. An asymmetric posterior tibial displacement indicates a PCL injury. Contralateral knee differences of greater than 12 millimeters on stress views suggests a combined PCL and posterior lateral corner injury. The lateral stress view is becoming the gold standard in diagnosing and quantifying PCL injuries. Another recommended view to get is a kneeling stress radiograph of the knee. An MRI is the confirmatory study for the diagnosis of a PCL injury. As far as treatment of a PCL injury, this can be either non-operative or operative. Non-operative management can include protected weight bearing in rehab or relative immobilization and extension for 4 weeks. Protected weight bearing and rehab is indicated for an isolated grade 1 that is a partial tear and grade 2 that is complete isolated injuries. The rehab for these injuries typically involves quadriceps rehabilitation with a focus on knee extensor strengthening. As far as outcomes, these patients will return to sports in 2 to 4 weeks. Relative immobilization and extension for 4 weeks is indicated for isolated grade 3 injuries. However, surgery may be indicated with bony avulsions or a young athlete. As far as modalities for this non-operative option, extension bracing is employed with limited daily range of motion exercises, and immobilization is followed by quadriceps strengthening. As far as operative options, this may include PCL repair of bony avulsion fractures or reconstruction, or a high tibial osteotomy, and we'll go into indications for each of these now. The indications for a PCL repair of a bony avulsion fracture or reconstruction is a combined ligamentous injury, such as a PCL plus an ACL or a posterior lateral corner injury, or a PCL plus a grade 3 MCL or LCL injury. Other indications include an isolated grade 2 or 3 PCL injury with a bony avulsion, or an isolated chronic PCL injury with a functionally unstable knee. Operative techniques can include primary repair of bony avulsion fractures with open reduction and internal fixation. Reconstruction options include a tibial inlay versus a transtibial method, single bundle versus double bundle grafts, and autograft versus allograft. Allograft is typically utilized with multiple graft choices available. Options include Achilles, bone patellar tendon bone, hamstring, and anterior tibialis. As far as outcomes, there are good results achieved with primary repair of bony avulsions. primary repair of mid-substance ruptures are typically not successful. Results of PCL reconstruction are less successful than with ACL reconstruction, and residual posterior laxity often exists. Successful reconstruction depends on addressing concomitant ligament injuries, and no outcome studies clearly support one reconstruction technique over the other. A high tibial osteotomy is indicated for a chronic PCL deficiency. As far as techniques, consider medial opening wedge osteotomies to treat both varus malalignment and the PCL deficiency. When performing a high tibial osteotomy in a PCL-deficient knee, increasing the tibial slope helps reduce the posterior sag of the tibia. Now let's go into some of these surgical techniques in a little bit more detail. Let's start with an arthroscopic transtibial technique. The approach to this is standard arthroscopic portals with an accessory posterior medial portal. The posterior medial portal is placed 1 cm proximal to the joint line posterior to the MCL, and make sure to avoid injury to the branches of the saphenous nerve during placement. The posterior medial corner of the knee is best visualized with a 70-degree arthroscope, either through the notch, that is a modified Gilquist view, or using a posterior medial portal. With respect to technique, transtibial drilling is done anterior to posterior, and make sure to fix the graft in 90 degrees of flexion with an anterior drawer. Results in knee biomechanics are similar to the native knee. The major con to this approach is a risk to the popliteal vessels. Moving on to an open tibial inlay, this approach uses a posterior medial incision between the medial head of the gastrocnemius and the semimembranosus. This technique is used for ORIF of a bony avulsion. As far as pros and cons, there's a biomechanical advantage with a decrease in the quote killer turn with less graft attenuation and failure, and the con is that screw fixation of the graft bone block is within 20 millimeters of the popliteal artery. A single bundle technique can be done either arthroscopic or open. As far as the technique, you will reconstruct the anterolateral bundle and tension at 90 degrees of flexion. The double bundle technique can also be done either arthroscopically or open. As far as the technique, the anterolateral bundle is tensioned in 90 degrees of flexion and the posterior medial bundle is tensioned in extension. As far as pros and cons, there's a biomechanical advantage with knee function in flexion and extension. However, a clinical advantage has yet to be determined. It may be advantageous to perform a double bundle technique with a combined PCL / posterolateral corner injury for better rotational control, as the posterolateral corner reconstructions typically loosen over time. As far as rehabilitation, postoperative care will involve immobilization and extension early and protection against gravity. Early motion should be done in the prone position. Rehabilitation focuses on quadriceps rehabilitation, and make sure to avoid resisted hamstring strengthening exercises such as hamstring curls in early rehab. This is because the hamstrings create a posterior pull on the tibia, which increases stress on the graft. As far as the prognosis, chronic PCL deficiency leads to increased contact pressures in the patellofemoral and medial compartments of the knee due to the varus alignment. However, it's controversial whether late patellar and medial femoral condyle chondrosis will develop. Finally, the major complications to be aware of are popliteal artery injury and patellofemoral pain / arthritis. As far as popliteal artery injury, the popliteal artery is at risk when drilling the tibial tunnel, as it lies just posterior to the PCL insertion on the tibia, separated only by the posterior capsule. And as far as patellofemoral pain / arthritis, this is due to chronic PCL deficiency.
Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic has been tested on past exams. The first question reads,
which of the following is considered an advantage of the tibial inlay fixation compared to transtibial tunnel technique when used in posterior cruciate ligament reconstruction? And the choices are 1, it's less invasive; 2, superior published clinical results; 3, decreased surgical time; 4, elimination of the critical 90-degree turn at the tibial aperture of the tunnel; and 5, improved cosmesis. So the correct answer to this question is 4, elimination of the critical 90-degree turn at the tibial aperture of the tunnel. So one of the most difficult aspects of posterior cruciate ligament reconstruction is placement of the tibial tunnel and passing of the graft through this tunnel. The tibial inlay technique requires a posterior medial approach to the tibia,
whereby the graft is directly fixed to the posterior aspect of the tibia. This obviates the need for a tibial tunnel. This technique has never been shown to be less invasive, more cosmetic, or require decreased surgical time. It has also never been shown in a published level 1 study to have superior clinical results. However, it does eliminate the need for the 90-degree critical, quote, killer turn and passing of the tibial graft through the tibial tunnel, which may lead to graft failure. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following rehabilitation techniques is appropriate for initial non-surgical management of an isolated grade 2 PCL injury? And the choices are 1. Immobilization in full extension for 4 weeks. 2. Immobilization in 30 degrees of flexion for 4 weeks. 3. Relative protection for 10 to 14 days, then range of motion with progressive plyometric exercises. 4. Relative protection for 10 to 14 days, then range of motion with gentle open chain hamstring strengthening. And 5. Relative protection for 10 to 14 days, then range of motion with gentle closed chain quadricep strengthening. So the correct answer to this question is 5, relative protection for 10 to 14 days, then range of motion with gentle closed chain quadricep strengthening. So treatment should consist of relative protection for 10 to 14 days, followed by early range of motion and gentle closed chain quadricep strengthening, making 5 the correct answer to this question. Isolated grade 1 and grade 2 posterior cruciate ligament injuries can be successfully managed non-surgically. Progression to global knee strengthening can begin 4 to 6 weeks after the injury, with return to functional activity when full range of motion and strength is established. Plyometric exercises involve rapid alteration of contraction and loading of a muscle and should not be used in the early rehabilitation of a ligament injury of the knee because it risks further injury to the ligament. Hamstring strengthening should be avoided until the ligament has healed, that is 4 to 6 weeks, because the posterior force of the tibia will stress the injured posterior cruciate ligament. Immobilization may be used for a short time to allow swelling and pain to subside, but early range of motion is preferred to avoid unnecessary stiffness following the stable injury. Moving on to the next question. At what angle of knee flexion should the graft be tensioned at during posterior cruciate ligament reconstruction with a single bundle graft? And the choices are 1. 5 degrees of hyperextension. 2. 0 degrees of flexion. 3. 15 degrees of flexion. 4. 30 degrees of flexion, and 5. 90 degrees of flexion. So the correct answer to this question is 5. 90 degrees of flexion. So for single bundle reconstructions, the PCL is usually tensioned in flexion, and the ACL is tensioned in more extension. While not truly isometric, these positions are closest to the isometric points, which means that the graft will not have excess strain or laxity as it is taken through a full range of motion. The paper by Margaritini et al. Describes 2 different methods of tibial fixation of PCL reconstruction. They found that transtibial reconstruction with combined proximal and distal fixation more closely restores intact knee kinematics and in-situ forces in the PCL at initial fixation than does reconstruction with distal tibial fixation alone. Moving on to the next question. Which of the following should be avoided in early rehabilitation following PCL reconstruction? And the choices are 1. Quadriceps muscle activation. 2. Closed chain active terminal extension exercises. 3. Prone passive flexion with active terminal extension. 4. Prone hamstring curls. And 5. Active maximal ankle dorsiflexion. So the correct answer to this question asking what exercises should be avoided in early rehabilitation following PCL reconstruction is 4. Prone hamstring curls. So resisted hamstring strengthening exercises, such as hamstring curls, are generally avoided in the early phase of rehabilitation following PCL reconstruction. This is because the hamstrings create a posterior pull on the tibia, which increases stress on the graft. Kaufman et al. Studied the joint reactive forces during isokinetic exercises. They found that posterior shear forces exist during the flexion portion of isokinetic exercise and during extension exercises at knee joint angles greater than 40 degrees. The maximum posterior shear force was 1.7 times body weight. Moving on to the next question, which of the following rehabilitation principles is true regarding non-operative treatment of a grade 2 PCL tear? And the choices are 1. Quadricep strengthening and prone range of motion should begin as tolerated. 2, hamstring strengthening and supine range of motion should begin as tolerated. 3, resisted quadriceps and hamstring strengthening with no early range of motion. 4, no strengthening for 6 weeks. And 5, no range of motion for 6 weeks. So the correct answer to this question is 1, quadriceps strengthening and prone range of motion should begin as tolerated for the non-operative treatment of a grade 2 PCL tear. So initial treatment for PCL tears is non-operative. Range of motion is typically initiated early. Flexion may be done in a prone position to limit posterior sag. While quadriceps strengthening is essential, resisted hamstring exercises are generally avoided initially because they pull the tibia in a relatively posterior position. Moving on to the next question. A football player sustains an isolated posterior cruciate ligament tear. Which of the following mechanisms is most likely to have caused this injury? And the choices are 1, fall on the flexed knee with the foot in plantar flexion. 2, fall on the flexed knee with the foot in dorsiflexion. 3, non-contact twist causing knee external rotation and valgus. 4, non-contact twist causing knee internal rotation and varus. And 5, direct contact blow to the posterior knee. So the correct answer to this question is 1, fall on the flexed knee with the foot in plantar flexion as the mechanism for a football player with an isolated posterior cruciate ligament tear. So overall, the most common mechanism of PCL injury is a direct blow to the proximal aspect of the tibia. The most common mechanism of PCL injury in athletes is a fall onto the flexed knee with the foot in plantar flexion, which places a posterior force on the tibia and leads to rupture of the PCL. Schultz et al. Retrospectively analyzed 494 patients with PCL injuries. Traffic accidents made up 45% of injuries, and athletic injuries made up 40% of injuries, and these were the most common causes. The most common injury mechanisms were dashboard injuries, making up 35%, and falls on the flexed knee with the foot in plantar flexion in 24% of cases. Multi-ligament injuries involving the PCL occurred in 64% of patients injured in traffic accidents versus 48% of those with athletic injuries with a p-value of less than 0.0001. Janusek found similar results showing that MVA was more likely to result in multi-ligament injuries, while a fall on the knee with the foot plantar flexed is most likely to result in an isolated PCL injury in athletic activities. Moving on to the next question. A 23-year-old collegiate soccer player sustained a right knee injury 6 months ago. He has been treated with rest and rehabilitation but is unable to play at his previous level due to his knee, quote, giving way. Physical exam reveals 10 degrees varus alignment when standing and a varus thrust with walking. Strength is full compared to the other side. Ligamentous exam reveals a stable ACL and MCL but opens to a varus stress and a 3+ posterior drawer and positive dial test at both 30 degrees and 90 degrees of flexion. What is the best treatment option to allow this patient to return to competitive athletic activity? And the choices are 1, functional bracing, 2, reconstruction of the PCL, 3, reconstruction of the ACL and PCL, 4, high tibial osteotomy to decrease tibial slope and correct varus malalignment, reconstruction of the PCL and the posterolateral corner, and 5, high tibial osteotomy to increase tibial slope and correct varus malalignment, as well as reconstruction of the PCL and posterolateral corner. So the correct answer to this question is 5, high tibial osteotomy to increase tibial slope and correct varus malalignment, as well as reconstruction of the PCL and posterolateral corner. So this patient sustained a combined PCL and posterolateral corner injury. The most appropriate treatment would be a high tibial osteotomy to increase the tibial slope and correct varus malalignment, as well as reconstruction of the PCL and the posterolateral corner. Altering the tibial slope is an important concept in the management of chronic PCL and ACL deficient knees with functional instability. For PCL deficiency, the slope should be increased. Increasing the tibial slope will shift the tibia more anterior relative to the femur. The increased slope will also prevent posterior tibia translation as the femur is more inclined to slide down the tibial slope, therefore keeping the tibia in a more anterior position. Griffin et al. States that increasing tibial slope in a PCL deficient knee reduces tibial sag by shifting the resting position of the tibia more anterior to the femur. This sag is even further reduced when the knee is subjected to axial compressive loads. Petrugliano et al. Examined the effect of proximal tibial slope on dynamic stability testing of the posterior cruciate ligament and posterior lateral corner deficient knees. They concluded that increasing posterior tibial slope diminished static posterior instability of the PCL/posterior lateral corner deficient knee as measured by the posterior drawer test. Moving on to the next question. A 35-year-old male sustained an isolated PCL injury over 5 years ago, which was treated non-operatively. If his follow-up radiographs showed degenerative changes related to his PCL deficiency, the changes are likely to be present in which of the following knee compartments? And the choices are 1, medial and patellofemoral, 2, medial only, 3, lateral, 4, lateral and patellofemoral, and 5, patellofemoral only. So the correct answer to this question is 1, medial and patellofemoral. So a PCL-deficient knee has an increased risk of early-onset degenerative changes in the medial and patellofemoral compartments. Strobel et al. Conducted a retrospective arthroscopic review of 181 PCL-deficient knees that were treated non-operatively initially, but later underwent knee arthroscopy. They found that PCL insufficiency significantly increased the risk of developing medial femoral condyle and patellocartilage degeneration over time. Of the patients whose PCL deficiency was present for more than 5 years, 77.8% showed degenerative cartilage lesions of the medial femoral condyle, and 46.7% showed cartilage degeneration of the patella. After 1 year of PCL insufficiency, the number of medial femoral cartilage lesions increased threefold, that is 13.6% versus 39.1%. And moving on to the final question for this topic, a 19-year-old running back lands directly on his anterior knee after being tackled. He has mild anterior knee pain, a trace effusion, a 2+ posterior drawer, a grade 1+ stable Lachman, no valgus laxity, and negative dial tests at 30 degrees and 90 degrees. What is the best treatment strategy at this time? And the choices are 1, physical therapy with a focus on quadriceps strengthening, 2, physical therapy and delayed PCL reconstruction, 3, PCL reconstruction, and 4, PCL and posterior lateral corner reconstruction. The correct answer to this question is 1, physical therapy with a focus on quadriceps strengthening. So this patient has likely sustained an isolated PCL injury. The examination is consistent with a grade 2 injury to the PCL. In this scenario, the best initial option is non-surgical treatment and return to play as symptoms subside and strength improves. Physical therapy with a focus on quadriceps strengthening and delayed PCL reconstruction is not the answer because this patient can likely be treated without surgery. The absence of valgus laxity and negative dial testing findings suggest that an injury to the posterior medial and posterior lateral corners has not occurred. Initial non-surgical treatment is indicated for this patient. If he completes rehabilitation and experiences persistent disability with anterior and/or medial knee discomfort or senses the knee is, quote, loose, PCL reconstruction should be considered at that time.
That's all for this review about PCL injury. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast thus far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.